Yeah, that's a really powerful
I think that's a
question.
beautiful question.
That's an interesting question.
That's a good
that is
question.
A great
that's
question.
A great question.
Questions, questions are really good questions.
Great question.
That's a good question.
That's a good question.
I love this question.
That is a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, and this is the second half of my conversation with memoirist Melissa Phoebos, author of The Dry Season, a memoir of pleasure in a year without sex. To listen to the first half of our conversation, head to mtpr.org. Let's get back to my conversation
this
with
idea
Melissa.
Really young for a lot of different reasons, but mostly because I grew up, you know, middle class in the United States of America in the 80s, mm-hmm. thinking, being empowered means doing it myself. Right. And mm-hmm. proving to myself that I'm powerful and strong and independent means that I don't ask for help. And my definition of being strong and empowered is actually the complete opposite of that now. And I first learned that when I got sober and entered into recovery. That was like the first time in my life I yielded to the fact that I needed to ask for help in order to survive and in order to thrive. But I kind of kept it to that area of my life. Mm-hmm. And it was still, you know, really uncomfortable for me for a very long time to ask for help. And so as a writer, you know, early in my career, I really kind of felt like I had to reinvent the wheel unnecessarily without choosing that. I just kind of did it, you yeah. know? And I feel like this year that I spent celibate kind of broke down the last vestiges of those old beliefs where I thought, oh no, this is not the way, you know? And because I was reading about these medieval women, I was reading about a lot of people. I was also revisiting some of my favorite like second wave and third wave feminist writers. And that's not what any of them were saying, mm-hmm. right? They were saying the only way we can do this, the only way we can survive and thrive in the face of hostile government is with the aid of each other, is together, right?
Well, you're no longer an emerging writer, right? Like you,
it's true.
Unfortunately,
I've
maybe,
had to
but
admit
not.
To myself
yeah,
that I have emerged.
you have emerged. You have many books under your belt at this point. But then I'm wondering, to keep going on this idea or to continue with it, did you then, during or after this year of celibacy, did you intentionally seek out those mentors that you had missed early on in your career or your writing life?
Yeah, I have. I mean, you know, I think there is something that sort of comes with a certain personality type, and it has to do with those misguided American ideas of sort of independence and individuality. But also, I'm an eldest daughter and kind of a type A personality. And it's always just come easier to me. I sort of collect mentees and little siblings, and it's just easier. And if I don't consciously think about it, I'm always like the big sister in the room. Mm-hmm. And so one of the ways that I have tried to grow sort of over the course of my adult life was by consciously seeking out sort of big sisters and mentors and older friends, people who are more experienced than me. It's just, it's a practice now because it has to be kind of analog because it doesn't happen instinctively for me. So I have to sort of reach out and try to cultivate those relationships. And so, yeah, that's been a practice that predates my celibacy, this experience, but I've definitely doubled down on since then.
Yeah.
Sort of trying to court and make friends who I can go to and learn from.
We've been talking about kind of the many different people that are populating this book, The Dry Season. In the second half of the book, you return often to an essay by Annie Dillard, one you've assigned to many of your students called Living Like Weasels. Melissa, how do you live like a weasel?
Well, this is something I've thought about quite a bit, of course. And, you know, in that essay, so nothing really happens in the essay except the speaker goes on a walk and locks eyes with a weasel, kind of has a sublime experience and kind of meditates on how to live, right? And the quote from that essay that has stuck with me the longest is, yielding at every moment to the perfect freedom of a single necessity, or of single necessity. And it was sort of this kind of, for years I would sort of turn it around in my mind, and I would encourage my students to do that, because yielding at every moment to the perfect freedom of single necessity is framing this idea of a single necessity, of devotion, as a perfect freedom. And what does that mean? And to me, it immediately makes me think of my devotion to art, right? When I was very young, sort of weirdly young, I made a decision to devote myself to this one form of art. And I think part of what led me to that devotion was the freedom, or the potential for freedom, that I saw in it. Because even as a kid, I mean, consciousness is super overwhelming. Human civilization is super overwhelming. Like, how to live was a question that overwhelmed me completely as a kid. And I thought, I was always someone who was really into kind of bibliomancy and looking for words to live by, or a credo, or, you know, I wanted something to simplify it, to distill it down to something I could live by and always return to. Mm-hmm. And devoting my life to a single practice or something, one thing I truly believed in. And, you know, I wasn't raised with a particular conception of God. I think that's what a lot of people find early on. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was art, and it was particularly writing. And if I can always come back to this one thing, then it sort of relieves me of all of these other decisions, or trying to kind of wade through the swamp of all these other belief systems I'm being offered that seem questionable. But it's always been really fascinating to me that a single necessity, yielding in every moment to a single necessity, is also a really succinct description of addiction, right? Mm-hmm. And what Annie Dillard comes to in that essay, and what I've come to in my life, is that the difference between sort of perfect freedom and bondage is choice, whether you get to choose your one necessity or not. Addicts think they choose, but they don't. They lose the power of choice really, really quickly, and then they're in bondage to it. Mm-hmm. But people who live according to a single devotion choose it day after day, hour after hour, you know? And that seemed to me a beautiful touchstone during that year, because I had been living in a way that was not based on my own choices. Mm-hmm. It was based on instincts that I'd inherited from other places, and parts of myself I hadn't really looked at clearly. And I thought, I want to bring choice into this. I want to make conscious choices and devote myself to forms of love that serve my true beliefs.
Mm-hmm. If we're talking about ideas of agency and and choosing, how does this idea of this one necessity of choosing, of agency, operate inside of a committed relationship for you?
I mean, it applies pretty perfectly, don't you think? I don't know if you're married, but but to me, marriage, the only kind of marriage that I was willing to enter into, I don't think this is true across history for sure, but fits that description exactly. It is a form of devotion that I choose day after day, hour after hour, and that simplifies and opens up my life, right? Mm. It is, I choose this one thing, and I'm thinking of sort of writing and my person and this one relationship kind of in the same way, talk about them in the same words. I am choosing this one beloved thing and forgoing other kinds of experience so that I can grow and bloom and experience what is only possible through this one devotion, right?
I'm thinking again of, the Beguines, freedom inside of restriction.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's too
absolutely
literal a metaphor for that idea or not, but
the Beguines had this saying, I forget what it is in Flemish. It's om something om, but it's all for all. Mm. And it really sort of feels like it could be a kind of credo for my marriage, where we're all for all, where the other person's well-being and spiritual growth and art practice and what is best for them is what's best for the other, like nurturing the other person's needs and growth is a form of nurture that we offer to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it, like, that's how the relationship works, you know? So I was not ever a person who fantasized about being married. I never thought I ever would be married. Although another part of me is surprised I haven't been married like 20 times.
Many times.
And I certainly didn't think at the end of this celibacy that I would immediately meet my future spouse. And in some ways, I wanted to keep that out of the book because it was so not the point of it.
Yeah.
By the end of that year, I truly believed I might never be in another romantic relationship because mm-hmm. I had a new definition and a new experience of love that felt so fulfilling, that felt so oriented to community and art practice and activism. And I truly felt so fulfilled. I couldn't imagine that a single person could add anything to that. I could only imagine that they might diminish it because that had been my previous experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, simultaneously, I had thought in a very concerted way about what kind of relationship would not threaten those other forms of fulfillment, would be a part of that larger definition, that more capacious definition of love. Mm-hmm. The Beguines wrote about God and used the word love interchangeably. Yeah. So they said love with a capital L. And I thought, I want to live inside love with a capital L. And if I can find a partner that fits with that, great. But I didn't feel at all confident that that was necessarily possible. And then I met Danica.
Yeah. I want to come back to finding this partner that fits mm-hmm. you so completely. I feel like that's a conversation about Virginia Woolf and maybe an example that she gives you. But in a memoir seminar that you facilitated by Story Studio Chicago, one over Zoom and one that I participated in, you said that the problem with chronology is that it doesn't often match up with the pace of human insight. That is, the ending mm-hmm. might not be mm-hmm. directly at the end of the chronological ending. It could be 6 months, a year after, right? Mm-hmm. So tell me about how you came to the ending of the dry season. And I mean that the literal mm-hmm. time that you mm-hmm. spent celibate, but the point at which you decided to end the book as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. And thank you for taking my class.
It was so good. It was so good. I returned to those notes over and over
and over.
Thank
you. I put a lot of preparation into that class. It was lecture based, which I'm not really used to, but it was actually so rewarding to just put down everything I know.
Yeah. It was incredible.
It was really fun. So that's gratifying to hear.
Yeah.
This is something I talk about so much in teaching memoir because you simply can't write a transcription of what happened because it would be so boring. Because the interesting part is in the insight, and insight doesn't come at the site of experience. It often comes many years after. And, you know, the experience took place almost 10 years ago now, and I had just begun the experience of those insights during that year. I mean, really, it felt like I got the map during that year. And at the end of that year, when I entered into the relationship that would become my marriage, that's when I started the real adventure, you mm-hmm, know? Mm-hmm. Getting married is like the end of the theatrical traditional comedy in theater, right? It's like the end of it, but everyone who's married knows that it's actually the beginning of the most interesting story.
Sure.
And so a lot of the most interesting stuff that comes up in this book happened after the celibacy ended. And I wanted to, I found ways as the future narrator of that book to include a lot of that stuff in the book. But there were also some things that happened that I wanted to allude to in a more literal way in the book. And so the main text of the book ends on the day that I meet her. But I just couldn't, there were such juicy bits that happened after that I had to fast forward. And so I have this kind of prologue where I went on this trip to visit the Beguinages and to sort of stand inside of those walls. And God, it feels like it's going to tear me up.
I was going to say, how does that feel? I can see that.
It was so meaningful. I thought, like, you're so corny. You're just going to go, are you going to go stand and have some feelings? like, it's this is probably just a self-indulgent exercise, and it totally wasn't, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, the experience of writing this book and of spending that time and of choosing those women, creating a kind of chosen lineage was so meaningful for me. It was like deeply, deeply meaningful. It was a deeply spiritual experience that I will have and keep for the rest of my life, mm-hmm. you know? And it is only by virtue of those role models and that experience that I was able to have the life that I have today and to have mm-hmm. the relationship that I have today. And it's not easy, you know? Making conscious choices is really hard work, and it never ends, you yeah. know? And so I thought, okay, if I'm going to end this book with me meeting someone that I fall in love with, I'm going to allude to sort of the depth and breadth of that work and that reward. And I'm going to have to fast forward to do this. So I fast forwarded 6 years mm-hmm. and have this this final little chapter, which is actually something that in the one other sort of straightforward memoir that I wrote, I also had to fast forward. It was only 6 months, right. but these were much deeper insights. So I needed 6 years.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And it made me want to be in that place with you.
Oh, great.
Yeah, which again speaks to the quality of your writing. You're listening to A Conversation with Melissa Phoebos. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Bookworks of Whitefish, offering new books of all genres, stationery, and puzzles. Open 11 to 6 Monday through Saturday and located in downtown Whitefish in the 3rd and Spokane building. You write in the book that, quote, I had mistakenly thought that sex was the closest I could get. Ironically, that approach had precluded all other forms of connection, as it so often did. Mm. More and more, Melissa, I am seeing writers writing of friendships as romances, mm-hmm. Usually women, but yeah, writing friendships in a romantic light. And you know, I alluded to this. You write about Virginia Woolf's romantic friendships mm-hmm. And kind of holding those against the marriage that she actually did mm-hmm. have. Describe this type of friendship for our listeners and how you contextualize it in this space.
Sure. Yeah. I spend a lot of time in the book sort of writing, looking at my relationship to romance broadly construed, and it's impossible to do that and not look at the many romantic friendships that I've had. And I think they began, as they do for a lot of women that I've talked to, in sort of childhood and adolescence with these like very passionate dyadic relationships with other girls where we were totally devoted to each other, sometimes in really tumultuous relationships, sometimes really kind of toxic relationships, but they were probably the closest thing I've ever experienced to this kind of romantic ideal that we're sort of sold in like pop songs and romance novels, which is totally unsustainable, has everything to do with like the first flush of infatuation, is full of like really messed up dynamics that are not conducive to like a healthy long-term relationship.
Right.
Jealousy, possessiveness, vindictiveness, mm-hmm. control, crazy hyperbolic promises. But looking back at those, I felt such tenderness and like, oh, these were my first loves, right?
Yeah.
And in the years since, you know, it's funny when a dear friend of mine read the book for the first time. She's one of my first readers, sort of before I gave it to my editor, I gave it to this friend. And she said, you know, it really is kind of a love story, but the love objects are your friends.
Oh, yeah.
Because in that year, the people who I spent the most time with and had the most intimacy with were my long-term friends. And those relationships had existed and had been that intimate. I had just been so distracted by my romantic relationships and put so much focus and emphasis on them that I had sort of overlooked the depth of intimacy that I was already experiencing and that was available to me in these friendships, mostly with other women.
Yeah.
And so that is, you know, a huge part of the love story in this book. And So one of the role models that I came to in thinking about sort of friendship and different forms of love was Virginia Woolf, mm-hmm. who sort of famously was married to her best friend. And they had this very sort of not sexy, mostly celibate yeah. relationship, but they deeply loved each other. And they were sort of partners in life and in mutual care and in devotion to their creative lives. But alongside that, she had these deeply romantic, sometimes sexual, but mostly romantic friendships with other women. And I think, you know, during my celibate year, I thought maybe this is what I need, right? Like a somewhat non-sex platonic partner right. where we can just support each other. And it's not tumultuous, so I can have my little romantic friendships on the side. And of course, that's not what I have. I actually do get to have sex and romance and partnership in the same relationship. But there was such an important lesson there. And she wasn't the only person I learned it from, but she was the primary one. And that lesson is that love gets to be whatever you want, whatever you need it to be, mm-hmm. right? When you are committed to making conscious choices, you get to decide what your marriage is, what your friendships are, what love means in your life. And that is such a powerful lesson for classes of people like women who have been prescribed for centuries what love, what sex, what attachment means based on the priorities of other people, mm-hmm. right? So it's in fact a very radical, very liberating, very independent act to say this is what mutual care, mutual aid, love, community means to me. I get to decide. We get to decide together.
I want to turn, we've talked about so much, but I want to turn as we kind of near the end of our conversation to the person to whom so many of us look to as kind of the patron saint of love and women and poetry, and that's Sappho. Mm-hmm. Melissa, talk about mm-hmm. the cover of your book.
I would love to. So there is this painting, this romantic painting of Sappho by Charles August Mengen, who's a French painter who is not really known for anything but this painting. And I had a crush on this painting starting maybe when I was a teenager, maybe not that, maybe in my 20s. And she is... she just looks exactly like my type, like a tall, brooding, smart, miserable, mask lesbian. You know, it's such a hot painting. And it's a beautiful painting, you know. She also just looks straight up exhausted. She's sort of like holding her lyre, but she just looks like, you know, she couldn't possibly bear to write another love song. She's so exhausted.
Or to hold herself up.
Yeah. And that is how I felt at the beginning of my celibacy. And, you know, I made this painting, the desktop on my computer, and I thought, okay, I want to make something beautiful like Sappho because I feel exhausted like Sappho, but let me try to do in a memoir what he did in this painting and paint a portrait of this that is also really... has a lot of depth, right? And it just felt like a kind of touchstone. And also the experience of feeling like, I mean, when I say I have a crush on a painting, I'm not just being cute. Like I really sort of like feel the feelings when I look at that painting. But it's a way of accessing the excitement, those exciting brain chemicals of feeling something for a work of art mm-hmm. that is... not manipulative or disruptive of another person's piece. It doesn't create an obsession in me that sort of is destructive in my life. I think it's an experience of the sublime. It's what we're meant to experience with art, to just find ecstatic corners of our humanity. And I thought, how can I rearrange myself in my life so that I am able to access these sublime feelings without it running my whole life and causing me to violate what I actually believe, you know, or to make messes of anyone else's life, right? How do I make my life bigger by experiencing these feelings rather than smaller?
Yeah.
And so it really felt like this beautiful sort of symbol of the work that I was trying to do in the book. And you know, I describe in the book also going to the Manchester Art Gallery and seeing the painting.
So big.
I had no idea. It's like 8 feet tall. It was just like, it's giving me chills right now thinking about it. And so when the time came to have the conversation about the book cover, they sent me a long questionnaire, my publisher, like what kinds of images, what kinds of mood. And I just pasted that painting into the answer of every single question and was like, I understand. It may not be possible, but I beg you, let's find a way. Yeah. And I am so grateful that they found a way to make it feel really modern and updated, but she is there. And it just makes me happy every single time I set eyes on it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. The Dry Season, alternative title, Exhausted Like Sappho.
That's
I love
right.
That. I love that. Melissa, would you read a passage from this memoir, The Dry Season?
I would be happy to. Okay. It is raining. Drops spatter against the plane's windows as we descend through the clouds and prepare for landing. The woman is seated four rows behind me, but I spotted her before we boarded, tousled hair in a wool beanie, leather boots belonging to the category worn only by lesbians and Dickensian orphans, giant backpack, and my seduction sonar locked onto her. I felt myself begin to glow with a chemistry visible only to the object of my attention. I do not understand the biological protocol that enacts once it's triggered, but I do know that more often than not, if I want it to, the end result is sex, and if my past is any indication, some sort of romantic entanglement. Just a few months earlier, I would have lurched at the call, but I am 6 months celibate and have made a promise to myself. In those first months, I was more vulnerable to the familiar siren song of a cute dyke, and while a few nearly pulled me back in, I'd managed to stay the course. The editor at the fancy book party, the film director, all the loose ends with whom I'd cut off contact months ago. But here I am, turning my profile to the angle mathematically most likely for her to see me, rolling my shirt cuffs up to bare a few inches of forearm tattoos, dangling my hand with its short, unvarnished nails into the aisle. Like most femmes, I am an expert at signaling my queerness through physical clues legible only to other queers. I can communicate my sexual identity through the set of my shoulders, if need be. I sit in the cramped airplane seat with my legs comfortably spread, my elbows on both armrests, exuding a physical entitlement to the space I occupy. So much of heterosexual attraction is contingent on the minimization and infantilization of the female body. Crossed legs, tilted heads, widened eyes, slackened mouths. A disregard for this affect suggests that a woman's desires lie elsewhere. This is why it's easy to mistake some women who have gone through menopause for lesbians. They have both stopped giving a fuck what men think of them. This secret language, in all its permutations, drove and defined over 2 decades of my life. I've largely abstained from it over the last 6 months. But now I think we're on a flight to London and unlikely to come any closer to one another than we are now. There is little danger of a full relapse. There's no harm in indulging the pleasure of the dance. I'll stop there.
Melissa, thank you so much for joining me today. This was a great conversation. I so enjoyed it and my reading of The Dry Season.
Oh, me thank too. You so thank much. You so much.
That was the second half of a conversation with memoirist Melissa Phoebos, author of The Dry Season, a memoir of pleasure in a year without sex. Out now from Knopf, an imprint of the Knopf Doubleday Publishing Group, which is a division of Penguin Random House. To listen to the first part of this conversation, head to mtpr.org. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.